time I'd ever had sex or the first relationship I'd ever had, and all the way to the forward, I could start now and go backwards, whatever I wanted, but they wanted it all. And I listed that. And in my own experience, you know, was I probably could have listed that on a cocktail napkin, but some people have a longer list. And I've worked with people that, and we'll talk about this a little more in the 10th and 11th step, but as sponsors in AA, you know, this causes people a lot of problems. And it maybe they would have been better to call this a relationship inventory than a sex inventory, because it's really more about relationships than it is the act of sex. Not that we don't have sex problems. It says in here, we all have sex problems. All of us. So I won't ask for a show of hands, but, you know, if there was somebody that didn't have sex problems, you know, they would be an anomaly, because the experience of the people that wrote the book. And my experience is that Tony doesn't. Yeah. And they're really dealing with relationships here. And so I wrote all of this stuff out. But as sponsors, which is where this deal's going, you know, we have to get comfortable with talking to people about sex. And it was an uncomfortable topic for me. And I was so glad that there was people that I could turn to about the sex problems in my life in sobriety. And I will also tell you this, that I did actually go see a sex therapist in early sobriety. I sat with a lady for a couple of years because I had my wires crossed. I mean, I was all over the board with stuff. And I want to be careful what I say here, but I received some horrible advice on sex in AA as well. You know, so you do have to be a little bit careful of who you're dealing with. But as sponsors, we got to get comfortable with listening to sex inventory, with sharing our own experience with whatever it is that we get comfortable on this topic. And I was asked to go through and list all this stuff out, look at whether it was selfish or not, look at where I was to blame, look at these questions, you know, where had I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, who'd been hurt, make a list of all that. And I realized in a lot of these relationships, it wasn't just the woman, or it wasn't just myself, but maybe it was her kids, maybe it was her parents. I mean, the list just grew, and I was able to use that information when I got to 9, and I had all this stuff together. And like I said, I was looking at where I was to blame, where was I selfish, where was I dishonest, where was I inconsiderate. I looked at all of those things in the fourth column, like, you know, where, what was my part in this. But still, I didn't quite get it. I got into step 5, and I was really thinking, you know, these guys in that workshop haven't exactly treated me with a lot of respect. So I asked the guy that was facilitating that to come hear my 5th step. And when I meant they weren't treating me with respect, there was a lot of times when I knew they were just kind of patronizing me. I'd speak up in the workshop, and I'd say, yeah, I got some experience with inventory or something, because I'd written inventory and treatment, you know, 5 years ago. And then they would, well, what was did you stay sober after that? And they these guys would make me look foolish in front of, you know, my peers in AA. And so finally I just kind of bit my tongue, and I knew better than to open my mouth at the workshop. And then sometimes they would actually patronize me a little bit. They would say, oh, that's good that you have all this experience with inventory, because you can come to the workshop and help to show everybody else how to write inventory when the time comes. And I think, oh, you know, because I knew I didn't know how to write inventory, you know. So I was just kind of riding on this 4-step, and I was literally of the opinion that when Jeffrey comes down to hear my 5th step, and he sees how horrible the people in my life have treated me all my life, he's going to be so sorry for the way that he's treated me. He's going to feel so, you know, he's going to feel so sorry for all of the hard times that I've had to go. He just doesn't understand all the rough times I've been through in my life. And he's going to see when he comes here's his 5th step. He'll see. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And I'm grateful that I picked a guy in 5 that wasn't afraid to really rub my nose in it a little bit. And he wasn't directly disrespectful, and he wasn't, but he just kept saying, well, what was that you said? No, I thought you said you loved your brother. But, you know, those things don't sound like love to me. Are you sure that you sure we're dealing with somebody that you love here? And he just, and it kind of, whew, you know. And then I had my mother ruin my life, Jeffrey. She ruined my life, and I don't see where I'm to blame for that, you know. Oh, okay. Well, was it all horrible? He said. And you know, I had like an awakening that day a little bit. Was it all horrible? And I thought, well, it wasn't all horrible, Jeffrey, but there was a lot of horrible. Okay, well, let's just get this in perspective because I really want to know what we're dealing with here. You know, this is somebody you say ruined your life, and I want to just see what's really, really going on here. So we thought about it, and you know, I thought, he said, well, did you have a roof over your head when I was a kid? Yeah, we had a roof over. Well, who took care of that? My mom was a single mom until I was about 8, and my stepdad married my mother, and we lived from then on with my stepdad. How old was your mom when you were pregnant? You know, this intuitive thought that these sponsors have. How old was your mom, by the way? I thought she might, and I knew, you know, my mom was 19 when I was born, and my mom, I have a brother that's 18 months older than I am. Yeah, single, in the 60s, with two young kids. And this is the person I was pointing the finger at. This person that put a roof over my head. Well, was there food on the table? Well, yeah, there was, but it wasn't always the right kind. You know, I never got the Captain Crunch and the sugared cereals and stuff. You know, we always had this crappy stuff from the food bank or something. But, you know, there was always food, and I thought about that. And was there a Christmas tree at your house at Christmas time? Yeah, we had a Christmas tree. Was there any presents? Yeah. Well, who do you think took care of that kind of stuff? Who was it that was doing those things for you guys? And I really got to look at my mom in a whole, you know, there's an idea that the blinders come off in 5. You know, that you can't continue, if you do a fist step, you cannot continue to do a fist step and continue with this tunnel vision. And Jeffrey used to call it the wraparound mirror. He said, you know, you've got this wraparound mirror. It's time to, like, reach out and shatter that wraparound mirror. And what the wraparound mirror is means that no matter what direction I look, I can only see how something reflects back on me. I can't ever see how anything affects anybody else except how it affects on me. And it perfectly described this selfishness, self-centered. And I would never have believed that I was a selfish, self-centered person. I just never believed that I was an egotistical person. I really had, like, dove heavy into this victim role. And you know, the more I think about it, my mom was a folk singer. She played guitar and she would sing at coffee shops in the U District in Seattle and raise money for us kids. And she had a full-time job on top of that. And we didn't have a TV when I was a kid. And my mom used to play guitar to us. And I got to thinking about that. You know, my mom used to play guitar to me every night. I don't ever remember a night when she didn't come into my brother and I's room and sit and play guitar for us and sing folk songs until we fell asleep. That was how she, you know, got us kids to sleep every night. So really what happened for me in 5 was kind of the blinders came off and I realized that there was problems in my family. I don't deny that. But, you know, I grew up in the presence of great love. That's a very loving thing that she did for us kids, all of those things. And I know that what she wanted in her heart of hearts was to be a great mom. And then I got to look at my side of the deal. At 13 years old, my mom got into Alcoholics Anonymous and recovered. And I never heard her amends, never wanted anything to do with her. I completely took the right for her to be a decent mother away from her. I went months and months and months without talking to her. I would, you know, I told you on Friday night, she would drive all the way to Seattle from Vancouver, Washington, about a 3-hour drive, and go up and down the freeways trying to find me. I was removed from the house about at 13 for my own problems because I was, you know, selling drugs in the school, and I was burglarizing homes, and I was doing all these things. And they removed me from the home, and I was a ward of the state. And during that time, there was a time that I was at a place called Nacell, Washington, which nobody would know here, but it's a little, tiny, tiny town way down in the corner of Washington State. Seattle is all the way up as far as you can get in the other corner of the state. And when I was incarcerated there at Nacell, Saturday and Sunday were the visiting days. And you know, I think back on that now, and I don't ever remember a weekend my mom didn't come visit me. And she drove from Seattle, and that's about a 4 or 5 hour drive. She would drive down there and see me on visiting hours on Saturdays. My mom would always be there. I just knew it. You know, Saturday, yeah, mom's coming. And then the neat thing about that is my mom would spend the night down there so she could come to visiting on Sunday as well. So you know, I was wrong about my mother. And then things just kind of started tumbling from there. I saw how wrong I was about my brother and my sister and my boss. And things kind of started falling apart a little bit, you know. And I was reminded in that fifth step that this isn't therapy that we're doing here. That the idea is that, and these were his words, you know, that your life is broken beyond repair here. We can't fix this. We can't put Humpty Dumpty back together. You know, it's broken beyond repair. This is about getting a new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to go out and set right these wrongs that you've done in the past. We're going to get this new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what this is about. This is about turning this stuff over to God because we can't do anything about it. This is about asking God to remove these things from your life so that you can live as a free man. And in that respect, you know, I was really able to go into that step 6 and 7, you know, humbly. God, you know, I cannot live another day like this. I didn't want to treat women the way that I did anymore. I didn't want to, you know, harbor those resentments against my family anymore. I didn't want to hold the resentments against the, you know, I had lists of just the stupidest goddamn resentments against these, you know, people at the hall that talked too much and, you know, this guy, just, you know, pitiful stuff. And just dozens of them. Dozens of them. I just, you know, I knew that I could not go on living this way for another day. And I just went into 6 and 7 with that attitude, that I really didn't want to go another day living my life that way. This girlfriend that I talked about is actually the mother of my daughter, who's 15, that lives with me now. And my wife, I've been with for 10 years. We've been married for 8. And my daughter lives with us. But she was there. She came back to, and this is the thing about this. I did that fifth step in the back of that car lot. That's where I was when I did that. The other thing about that fifth step was that before I did that fifth step, I was, you know, Jeffrey was one of those kind of no-nonsense sponsors, and he said that, you know, I asked him if he would hear my fifth step, and he said, yeah, I'm a busy guy. You know, I do a lot, and I'd seen that. I'd been to his apartment. I'd seen what this guy was doing with alcoholics, and I'd seen that, you know, what he was. He says, well, here's the deal. And he opened up his little book, and he circled the date on the calendar, and he said, I'm going to be down to the car lot. I'll come on this day. We'll go in the little apartment back there, and we'll do your fifth step. So I'm going to show up on that day because that's the day that's open on my calendar. And if you're not ready, I won't come back. You'll have to find somebody else. And that night before that fifth step, I wasn't finished with my inventory. And I stayed up all night that night writing that inventory. So this fifth step experience that I described to you was on no sleep, and it was born of desperation. You know, I really thought about, I would go up to the top of the car, I could see out, there's this little AM, PM mini mart, a little gas station, and I could see out there, and I knew that for like $6, I could go down there and buy a cheap bottle of wine. And I was thinking, that was an absolute decision on my part before 5. I thought, I could go down and get that bottle of wine, I'll drink it real fast, and when Jeffrey shows up, I'll be so stinking drunk, and I'll tell him what I think of him and all his cronies there at the workshop. You know, it just is a miracle to me that I was spared from some of that kind of stuff. I'd think about that, and I'd go down, and I'd write that inventory for a while. Then I'd come back up, and I'd think, oh, man, I'm going to bag this. I can't finish it. There's no way I can finish by morning. But I did, and my daughter's mother had left, and then she'd come back. I was in the car lot, and I had myself there, and then I'd had my daughter's mother there, and then she got pregnant. And then later on, I started, you know, they told me you got to give it away to keep it. So I went down and found Alan. He was on a park bench in Pioneer Square, and I brought him up to the car lot. And that's when Al said, hey, get out, you and all your, you know. But, you know, she'd come back, and she could see that something had changed in me. I mean, she just walked in, and she immediately was like, wow, what happened in your fifth step? And I didn't even know how to put it into words, really. But, you know, for the people that haven't done it or people haven't done it, you know, it's experience not to be missed. And I hope you'll all find somebody like that to read inventory to, somebody that is truly living a spiritual way of life, that is kind and loving enough to show you kindness and love when you need it, and is not afraid to turn the mirror and say, "Did you see that? Did you see what you're looking at?" And ask those kinds of questions. And it's just the type of sponsorship that I come from. I don't come from a type of sponsorship where we just read an inventory to a wall kind of a thing, and then somebody says, "Well, yeah, I've done all those things too." Not that that's not a valid experience, because I think it is in a lot of cases. It gets by when this other deal is not available. But if you have, like you guys have here, you've got this solid lineage of sponsorship here available to you. You know, make use of it and get into a fifth step. We have a guy that's from Chicago that's kind of back a few generations in our sponsorship lineage. And I hate to even use that word, because it's really not true for me. You know, I mean, you know, my first sponsor was Al. He's the guy that saved my life in the car lot. Then I used a step sponsor, Jeffrey, for a while. His sponsor was a guy that was sponsored by this California guru, but his sponsor's not even in AA anymore. He's off doing the Scientology deal, and he's doing well, but you know, he's not in AA anymore. The lineage kind of, but there's a guy in Chicago, and he really believes in the multiple fifth step deal. And it comes from and I asked him really about what the history of this multiple fifth step. And it really comes from this psychiatrist that he had studied at one time. And this psychiatrist had this belief that the more that we admit these things, the less power they have over us. And the more that we see that other people have these same troubles. So take your inventory to more than one person. And the book says that. It says we think about the person or persons whom we're going to take this intimate and confidential step with. So you can read to your sponsor, and then you can go to somebody who may be considered a spiritual advisor. Maybe you can go to... currently, I read most of my inventory that I write now. I will read to the people that I have sponsored. You know, I've sponsored for long enough now where I have friends in the program more than me sponsoring them. And this is what the book describes. We'll talk about that more in steps 10, 11, and 12. But the book really describes it. That's what should be available to us, is that we will be shown how to create this fellowship that we crave. It says, you know, if you live in a big city, it says near you, lying helplessly, dying hopelessly, are the future friends of Alcoholics Anonymous, the future members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it says something really spectacular. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. These people, I might not meet the lifelong friends here at this retreat. They might be lying out there drunk, dying hopelessly. Among them, I'll make lifelong friends. I've got an answer for those people. I can reach my hand out to a still suffering alcoholic, and I've had this experience over and over again where the book really describes it. There's three ways they describe these people that we're going to meet. The first one that they use is the book calls them a prospect. And I've always liked that. Oh yeah, I got a prospect. You know, in the biker culture, if they kind of identify a guy they think might be able to keep his mouth shut and kind of toe the line, they'll say, "Oh, this guy's a prospect. Yeah, we're prospecting this guy right now. He's not really a member yet. He's not even been asked to join yet, but he's a prospect." And AA uses that word in the big book, this idea of a prospect, that we look around, this guy's... And I've had that experience. I'll see that face of hopelessness, kind of make an approach, talk to a guy a little bit. The next week, "Oh, yeah, how you doing? Yeah. How's that going with your whatever it was?" And talk to him for a little bit. And next thing you know, we're talking about doing step work. "Well, yeah, maybe you come over to my house sometime." And, you know, there's a prospect deal going on. And then the next thing they say, they say that it's a pro... They say, "Well, you and your protege." And a protege is a guy that we're taking through the steps, and he wants what we have. And there's nothing wrong with having proteges. You know, I like to consider myself a protege for a number of people that I've met through the years in the program, and I'm quite honored to be considered, you know, that in their lives, that these are people that have agreed to mentor me in the program, that I can call at any time and let them know what I'm doing. And so it says these protege, and a protege is a guy, I'm taking this guy through the steps, or this girl through the steps, and they kind of want what I have. We're going through the steps, and they're the protege. And then they wrap it up and they say that you and your friend. And that's where we should be getting with people that we sponsor. You and your friend will commence a common journey, shoulder to shoulder. That means that we're doing something together. And this is really what I told you, I've got that AA number 3, the picture of the man in the bed, is up on the wall in the room where I work with people. And I love that picture because it represents something to me. It represents that you and your friend. That this is the idea that I am going to help somebody else get sober. And then the two of us are kind of equal and we're going to go out and get AA number 3. So I tell people that now. When people move away, I've had a lot of people that got sober around the Seattle area, and we got really good sobriety, really good meetings there, really good foundation for working the steps for people. And then they might go to some other part of the country where they don't feel they have that good, and they're like, boy, I don't know what I'm going to do down there. And I tell them, look for AA number 3. You got to get AA number 2 first, but that's not what this is about. Let's get AA number 2 in place, but the idea is let's be looking for AA number 3. That's what that man in the bed picture is about. That picture is a painting of Bill W. and Dr. Bob at the bed of AA number 3, Bill D. Bill, huh?
Dobson.
Bill Dobson, there we go. You know, these guys at the bed of this guy that was going to become the third guy to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so these guys were friends, and look what they were able to do. They weren't. I've really come to believe in that I have. So I read a lot of my inventory when I get down and I write inventory. I will read it to my friends in AA as much as I'll read it to my current sponsor. You know, I have a lot of people in my life now that I'm not afraid to, and they know everything about me. There's nothing about me that I hide from them. There's nothing about me that, and I need that. You know, I need that ability to have that group of people in my life that does know everything about me, that I do this, the inventories with and the 10 steps with. And so I think we're getting close. It's 12:45. I think the idea is that we're going to take a little bit of a break and we're going to come back around 1:30. So before we do that, is there any questions and comments that people have? I do have this microphone here if people want to ask questions or make comments. We've covered an awful lot this morning. We've kind of come from step 2 all the way up through 6 and 7. We come back, we're going to look at steps 8, 9 and get into some really great stuff with 10, 11, and 12 as well. So does anybody have any questions or comments? And I'd be glad to reach back and grab the microphone if there is. So just raise your hand and I'll... Yeah. I think it's. I'm sorry that made so much noise, but I think it's better for the burner back here. If you use that mic.
I'm Erica. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Okay. So the question I have is about writing inventory, and when it's not based on someone is wrong because of, or I'm angry at someone because of, but there's like a dark cranny sort of feeling like. Something happened at some point. I'm not resentful about it. I'm not angry about it. But I'm pretty sure there's an amends there somewhere.
Uh-huh.
So how do I...
This is like about a particular person?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then you put them on an 8-step list and look at what is it that you owe an amends for. And that's a good question. You know, just because we don't have to start with a resentment. I mean, I owe amends to people that I don't have any resentment for. I know that I need to see this person, but I don't necessarily have an amends. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but... You talked about that dark feeling like something's wrong, that you need to talk to that person. Is that the... Yeah,
I mean, the question is for myself, for my own amends, and it's also for leading a sponsee through inventory. You know, like they're asking, what do I do with that stuff? And I don't know.
Well, you put it on an 8-step list, for certain. I mean, that's what we do with people that we owe amends to. And we'll talk about that more later, but, you know, we get a lot of names off our 4-step inventory and some of the discussions that we had in 5. Help us to, you know, the book actually says we have this list of these people. We made it when we took inventory. But there's a lot of people that are not on, you know, and the book tells us that there may not be a resentment in connection with these people that go on our 8-step list. Yeah? Yeah, please, Tom. We'll just have people step up here. So.
I told Juanita I wouldn't do this. Yeah,
did I really?
My have to make amends to the group again. Tom, an alcoholic. In the spirit of that line in the eighth step, we had our list. We made it when we took inventory. What some of us do is we keep an extra page when we're writing inventory called harms list. And the idea is that I'm stirring this pot as I'm writing inventory, this psychic pot, and a lot of stuff's going to float to the surface. And if a random, you know, person floats to the surface, I don't have sex, conduct, fear, or resentment necessarily, but I go, oh, my God, you know, I did this to them. Then I put them on that list as I'm writing inventory, and it kind of takes them out of my it kind of quiets that stuff so I can go on with my inventory. And then I have that to use when I get to the eighth step. And that's been really helpful for a lot of people, the harms list that you do as you're writing inventory.
Oh. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Adam.
Hey, Adam.
And in relation to the sex part of our inventory, you know, I've heard it said that, you know, you list people that you've had sex with, all the way to, you know, everybody that you've ever flirted with, used my, you know, sexual powers, God-given sexual powers in relationship to. And what's your impression of that? It seems like it's one extreme to the other.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question. I should have maybe clarified that a little better. I have a microphone, so you can just turn that off until somebody's ready. The answer to your question is, as sponsors, you know, we have to be aware and careful of this, because there are people that have a very short sexual inventory, and there are people and that where sexual addiction is concerned and that kind of thing. There's people that you know, we've had and I'm struggling here. I just want to make sure I'm not sharing any, you know, intimate details of anybody's inventory or anything. But there are people, you know, amongst us in Alcoholics Anonymous who have suffered, you know, years of sexual addiction. And I said, you know, like for me, I had to go and do some sexual therapy. And I'm so happy I admit that, because every time I talk about that, people come to me and say, well, what, you know, what was the deal? And man, I have people come out of the woodwork to talk to me about this kind of stuff. And it was a good thing for me, because I was able to really see that I used sex in that way. I'm not a sex addict, but I sure was a potential sex addict, because I used it as a way to nurture myself. And as a young child, I'd learned how to use sex as a way to nurture myself. It was one of the only ways I knew, you know, I was choking myself and doing drugs and sniffing glue and stuff, but this sex deal was just another way to try to make myself feel good. And when I brought that out into my adult life, it created a huge havoc. And there's people that carry that sexual addiction to the serious extremes, and we will sponsor people like that. And so for some people I've sponsored, I've just had to say, okay, let's just say the prostitutes in San Francisco and write one piece of inventory on that. And let's say the prostitutes in this area. And I've sponsored people that belong to sexual clubs where they would, you know, join these associations where it was just kind of, you know, where they maybe had hundreds or thousands of sexual partners. And we have to be aware of this when we're sponsoring people. You cannot let the inventory turn into a document that can't ever be finished. You can't ever do that. Somebody remind me, you know, I want to tell a story, but it'll take about 5 minutes. I don't think we have time now, but somebody remind me to tell you about Patrick's inventory, and I share this with his permission, and he and I, you know, he knows that I share this, and he actually thanks me for it. He likes it that I share stories about our early sobriety, because, you know, it's just a genuinely good thing for both of us to remember. So, but he was a guy that wrote... I'll just tell you this. I won't take 5 minutes to tell the story, but I will just tell you, this is what we got to watch out for. And in sexual inventory, it's the same. Sometimes we need to categorize or try to find ways to get somebody. It's not the last inventory we're going to do. Just get somebody into five. It does have to be thorough, but to list thousands and thousands and thousands of names. And Patrick actually wrote on around 3,000 resentments. Yeah. 3,000 resentments. And, you know, the sad thing about that was I didn't know any better, and he wasn't in touch with anybody. He was living down there. It was mental illness, and he sat down in that apartment, and he wrote tablet after tablet after tablet after tablet, and he couldn't stop. And no one was down there to put controls on that. I tell people, if you get to around 100, 120 names, you better call me, and we're going to see if maybe there's some repetition, because instead of writing on politicians, you know, he went all the way back to Eisenhower and went forward, you know, and I mean, that's the truth. That's the truth. You know, pages and pages. He was a Vietnam era guy, and you know, pages on Nixon alone, you know, and so but he wrote on this. And here's the neat part of this story, why it takes a couple minutes to tell, is that Patrick asked me to hear his inventory. And it was the first guy that I'd ever heard inventory with. This guy comes, and he'd left his window open one night, and he had his inventory, like all these bundles of inventory stacked up, and the rain came, and it rained on his inventory. All these thousands, this life's work. It took him about a year to write this thing, working full-time every day to write this inventory. And the rain came, and he had to spread it all out and dry this whole thing out, try to save it. He was absolutely bananas about this. And he finally got it. But so this guy came here with this inventory. Not only was it this huge inventory, but it was all swelled up and kind of. And I didn't know what to do with it. So I listened to his inventory for 2 days, and we just made a scratch in it. And I didn't know what to do with it. And so I called Jeffrey, and I said, you know, what are we going to do? Patrick's in a bad way here. I told him, well, we don't need to read all of it. Oh, yeah, I said, you know, I mean, it was like he had a lot of power in that. And Jeffrey, you know, he was this very intuitive guy, still is, just a really amazing guy. And he said, well, tell Patrick to call me. I'd sat with Patrick for 2 days, and I didn't, you know, we weren't getting anywhere. We were just reading and hadn't even got through the first couple of notebooks. So I sent him to Jeffrey, and Jeffrey told Patrick, I will sit with you, and we'll meet a couple times a week, and we'll read inventory. And Jeffrey had the understanding to just sit there and listen. And Patrick read and read and read and read week after week after week after week. He came over and read. And finally one day that deal cracked, and Patrick said, I can't do it anymore. I cannot sit here and just read this crap anymore. And thank God for that. You know, that guy was able to emerge from that mental illness, really, was what it was. You know, he had just kind of spiraled into this obsessive disorder that caused him to have this need to just read. And you know, Jeffrey, the two of them tell the story now. And Patrick said, I got to a place where I just couldn't do it anymore. And I just told Jeffrey, I can't read anymore. I can't do it. I cannot do this. And Jeffrey said, you read. You read every word of that. You know, I have sat here and you've wasted my time week after week after week. I've sat here and now you're going to see how it feels, dude. And he said, you're going to read that inventory. And Jeffrey sat with that guy until he read every piece of that deal. And he emerged from that deal. If I think about it, let's ask the next question, and then I'll read you something, that a little note I got from Patrick a few years ago.
Nick, alcoholic.
Nick.
This is going back to last night, but yeah. I wanted to ask the question because I didn't understand, but I just remembered it today, mm-hmm. right, like a few minutes ago. So what did you mean when you said before you sit down with a guy, you become anonymous? I didn't quite understand that.
Oh, what I meant by that is that it's the spirit of anonymity, which means that God works through us. It means that this spiritual experience that I've had as a result of the steps was not meant for me. I've really come to believe that I'm anonymous in this process I'm doing here. And I hope everybody gets that this isn't about Kenny D coming down from Seattle. You know, there's a bigger picture of what's going on. I don't exactly know what that is, but I can give you the microcosm of it. And the microcosm of it is that my spiritual experience is more important to my daughter than it is to me. I can clearly see that. You know, I'm anonymous in this deal that's happened to me. It's not about me. One of our mentors, you know, was really fond of saying, Kenny, don't put your thumbprint on this deal. It doesn't belong to you. You know, don't come up with a step guide on how to work the steps and put your name on it. It's okay to give people instructions, but let's not put your name on it. You know, it's the spirit of anonymity. And that's what I meant. When I'm working with a newcomer, I will pray, say that prayer that I said maybe before I even open this, that, you know, that God, you know, please be our guide here. Guide my thoughts, my actions, and especially our words as we go through this 12-step process, that God is the guide here. I'm just the vehicle. So that's what I meant by that. This is a note I got from Patrick a few years ago. And Patrick, I want to be, Patrick's had his struggles, but and he's currently going through some struggles. We could keep him in our prayers. But, you know, this was a guy that came off the skids, this guy with all these resentments that was down there just suffering from mental illness. And this is, every time I look at this, it does the same thing to me. So people don't usually worry. My home group members know this about me. They don't worry about me. They just tell people, oh, he'll recover. He'll be okay here in a second. Just hang on. This is from Illinois State University. And this little note came in the mail a few years ago. It says, thanks for everything over the years, Pat W. And it says, the faculty, staff, and graduating class of Illinois State University. Announced that Patrick Welsh is a candidate for the degree of Master of Science in Political Science with a concentration in Applied Community and Economic Development at the Commitments Exercise Saturday, December 15th, 2001 at 9 o'clock. Isn't that amazing? That this would be from that story that I just told you? Yeah. These are these transformations in that we have here in AA. You know, you don't want to miss this. That's what they say the bit about the 12-step work. You don't want to miss this. You get to see these people completely transformed. Completely transformed. You know, this guy that got a master's degree in political science from Illinois State University is not the same Patrick that was down in the basement writing that inventory month after month and you know, week after week, month after month. You know, this is a guy who's been reborn here in AA and has got this new life today. And, you know, he's got this applied community and economic development. And so he's currently back and forth to Iraq trying to help to kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again and use some of the stuff that he's been taught for, you know, this redevelopment stuff is kind of his specialty. And so that's what he's doing now. So with that, unless there's any other questions, I think it is about noon and time for the break for lunch. So we will reconvene at 1:30. Is that correct? Does that sound like gives us an hour and a half to eat lunch and kind of get some exercise? And when we come back, we'll talk about kind of how many more sessions we want to do between then and dinner and then what we want to do after dinner. We'll talk about that a little bit before we start the next section and start the tape roll, and we'll have a little group conscience here. So thank you, everybody. My mic is on, huh? Is that working? Okay, welcome back, everybody. We got the thumbs up from our burner there, so welcome back. We will go ahead and do about a quick 1 or 2 minute silent meditation to kind of bring the group back together. If people continue to join us through the evening, we will just continue to make the circle larger. So if anybody's outside the circle wants to come in the circle, that's great. And if you're not, if you're more comfortable in the back, that's all right too, but yeah. So okay, so we actually have plenty of empty chairs, so if somebody wants to move in, they can. There's one here, there's a couple here. So we will go ahead and I will ring the meditation chime, and that will remind us that we're coming back into session as a group, and we'll do a minute or two meditation. I'll bring us out of that with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Mother, and Child, Lord of the happy, joyous, and free, we thank you for your presence here with us this weekend, and we'd ask for your continued guidance as we go forward from here in this retreat here at the Glorieta Conference Center. We'd ask that you would be our guide here, that you would guide our thoughts and our actions, and especially our words, that you would fill us with your love and allow that love to overflow to the many people in need and that will be in our lives. Amen. So we are on the ninth step. I think we'll kind of start making this transition to 8 or 9. Yeah, Tony.
We didn't talk about 6 and 7,
though. No, we will. Do you want to talk about 6 and 7 for a minute? Yeah, yeah. We did. You know, I shared a little bit of my experience in 6 and 7 that, you know, if you looked at 6 and 7, and thanks for reminding me, I think maybe we'll cover that just real quickly here. But if you look at 6 and 7 in the big book, it's really a couple of paragraphs. And it's really, you know, there's times in the book where they give us the at once and we launched and now there's action and more action where they really give us these kind of keep moving signals. And 6 and 7 is one of the things where they give us a signal where, you know, it's kind of a when ready deal. And 6 and 7 can be like the experience that I described right after that first fist step where I was just completely humbled, and I just, God, please, I cannot live another day like this. And 6 and 7, and I've had instructions, and I won't get into too much of that, but I've had instructions further on into my sobriety where people wanted me to sit with some certain ideas and really make certain that I was really ready to let go of this financial issue or really ready to let God enter into my life in this area, or that I was, you know, some of the kind of the further layers of peeling the onion, if you will, that I've had some of that time where I've really needed to sit in 6 and 7 before it actually came to me. The when ready was maybe a week or two after I'd done 5. But in the 7th step prayer, you know, it's asking God to remove those things that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And that's been such a useful thing for me to see for myself and also for other people, because doesn't mean that God's going to come in and remove all of those things. God is going to come in and remove all those things that are blocking me from my usefulness to God and my fellows. And that doesn't mean everything, that I'm quite an imperfect person. And it's some of those, there are some of those attributes and things that some people may see as shortcomings. Maybe those are the very same things that some of the people I sponsor really love about me. You know, sometimes I don't focus and pay attention, and they'll be talking about something, and then I'll come off the wall with some idea that's totally out of left field, and they'll kind of laugh. Oh, there he goes again. You know, he's off on some tangent or something. So I have these kinds of things, but God is the one that determines that. When I say it's been useful to me myself, as well as other people, if I, you know, there was a time in my sobriety where. You know, I was dropping the F-bomb right and left in meetings. It was just part of my vernacular. And I would just use it. People would get offended by it and stuff. You know, I was sponsoring people successfully during that time. And the, you know, when I was first in the program, you know, I was attracted to people that kind of had this rugged edge and they were real hardcore and stuff. God made those people useful. And God made me useful. And it's just something that kind of just went away without a lot of effort on my part. It just isn't a part of who I am anymore. I just don't use that kind of language. And it wasn't a big effort on my part. You know, I really prayed for that to go away, and I prayed for it, but it just kept coming out. And now in meetings, when I hear people using that kind of stuff, I can just think, well, that person's not talking to me. And it'd be pretty selfish of me to sit around and think that everybody that speaks in the AA meeting should be talking directly to me and saying something that I agree and like. And so I can look around and say, well, that person's probably being useful to somebody else. And maybe some new guy that wouldn't be attracted to me will go up and ask this guy to sponsor him. And, you know, that I think that it's a really nice way to look at 6 and 7 is it's the ability, it's asking for me to put this stuff in God's hands and not my hands. And God will remove this stuff to the degree that he finds that it's blocking me from my usefulness to others. So I don't know if that helps a little bit. It's hard to really for me to talk a long time on 6 and 7. There is quite a long dissertation on 6 and 7 and the 12 and 12, and it's very beautiful stuff. And I would encourage everybody to read it because, you know, we do look at like two paragraphs in the big book on 6 and 7 versus two chapters in the 12 and 12. And they you know, there is some expanded ideas that we can get out of this. But that's the core for me. You know, 6 is to be done immediately following 7. And 6 is to be immediately done following 5. And 7 is to be done when we've really looked at 6 and we're completely ready to say, God, I don't know what's going to happen with these character defects, but as far as they're standing in the way of my usefulness to you, I'd ask that you'd remove them. And you say a prayer, and we, you know, then, once you've said that prayer, then it says that now we need action and more action. So now we're looking at step 8 and 9. They don't give us a lot of time to really reflect, and I kind of like that. You know, it's something that we should do. Some people do that with their sponsors. When I do it with people, I do the fifth step. When I'm done with doing the fifth step, I give those people instructions for the hour after, for going back and looking at all those cornerstones in the books and going back and doing that review step, that hour of review. And then I ask them on their own to do 6 and 7, and I tell them to call me when they're done. And then we will talk about what that experience was like for them, what kind of things they happen in 6 and 7. And then we immediately start getting them to write their 8-step list. So I did have some other things, and we are going to talk about steps 8 and 9. But I had some, you know, I've had some questions and some things that I thought about. I was talking with Karen and Juanita at lunch up here, and Karen said something that made me have a thought. I talked about one of these guys who has been a mentor to me that was, I heard somebody describe him one time. They introduced him to the podium and they said, you know, I want to introduce one of AA's great sponsors. And I really believe that guy was that. He sponsored a couple of people, I think, here in this room maybe even. He's gone now. But one of the other great AA sponsors that a lot of people know is Chuck C. You know, he's another guy that was described in the same way. People really believe him to be one of the really great AA sponsors. He sponsored a lot of people. He traveled all over the country for years and years and years. He's been gone, I think he's been gone maybe my entire sobriety. Is that right? 84. I got sober in 89, so he was definitely gone 5 years before I got sober. But he left behind, you know, a great lineage of people, and people still out there doing great work. And you know, one of the things that he said in this deal, that this conversation reminded me about that. They taped one of these retreats that he did, and he used to call it. And I actually don't think he actually ever really liked it. I think I remember reading that about him. He didn't like that people referred to it that way, but they would call it, you know, that he would have church. You know, they would say, "Oh yeah, Chuck C's coming to town. We're going to have church," which meant that Chuck C would come, and they would get a group of people would always come, and they would just ask him questions and answers. But he did one of these retreats that was taped. And then they turned it into a book called A New Pair of Glasses. They took the recordings and put it in a book form, and it's called A New Pair of Glasses. And if you have never read it, you really owe it to yourself. It was just an amazing retreat, and it kind of came out of a conversation. They said, "Chuck, with all the work that you've ever done in AA, what was really kind of the top thing that you really remember where you really felt like your message was right on?" And they said he didn't even pause. He said, "Well, it was that men's retreat that I did at that location," and they got the tapes and they turned it into a book to kind of get the essence of Chuck C a little bit. But in that New Pair of Glasses, you know, he talks about that he was living in that same house, sitting in that same chair, had to make that same that driving that long commute, driving that same car, been married to that same woman every day. He was doing that, and he just felt like he was in hell. He just felt like he was in hell. Just this monotonous thing is driving him crazy. And then he had this experience that we've been talking about here, working the steps. And he said after that I was married to that same woman. I was sitting in that same chair in that same house, making that same long commute, 2 hours each way to Los Angeles, working at that same company. And I felt like I was in heaven. And he says, you know, maybe heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And I just always love that deal that nothing, you know, that nothing on the outside really needs to change for me to get better. And it was such good news that none of that inventory stuff, you know, all those people and all, none of that stuff had to change for me to get better. You know, all those other people could stay the same and all the conditions can stay the same, that it never is the outside stuff. And it drives the people I sponsor nuts, because they'll come to me with this big problem about her. You know, she's really big, big problem. And I say, well, you know, it's not even remotely possible that this problem has anything to do with her. And it drives them nuts. Whoa, you know, I hate it when you keep saying that, you know. And but it's been my experience. You know, my experience is that that it's not even remotely possible that the problem ever exists outside of myself. And it's great news for us here in AA, isn't it? That you know, the terms aren't outside of this spiritual experience. You know, this work that takes place within ourselves, the answer is never any further. You know, they say that, you know, like he is closer than hands and feet. It's the answer is just right there. And the other, I had a couple other comments and stuff. And this kind of goes to sponsorship. We will come back to the amends here in a minute. But a couple people have asked me, like, well, what do you do when somebody's doing this? Or somebody asked me, well, how many times do you let somebody not show up before, you know, what's the limit, you know, before you kind of have to cut them off? And I'm always a little uncomfortable with those kind of questions because, you know, there is no real answers to a lot of this stuff. And even in the spiritual life, that there isn't, you know, it's the hard and fast, not the hard and fast, but just these hard one-line answers, you know, they don't sometimes really fit the bill very well when you're actually doing the work in the spiritual life. And a lot of what we'll talk about the rest of this week, and we'll get to 8 and 9, we'll talk about, you know, the 10th and 11th step is really about inspiration. And it's about intuitive thought. This guy that I was talking about that is one of the A's great sponsors, not Chuck C, but Don, you know, the thing that I noticed about this guy was he probably is the most intuitive person I ever met. You know what I mean? That guy could pick the face of hopelessness out of a huge crowd. You know, and he found me that way. You know, at the World Convention in Seattle, you know, he and I had a chance to talk and kept running into each other. He just was an intuitive guy that would just intuitively know, okay, well, what's going on? And you know, he just had just this deal. This work kind of prepares us in that direction, this intuitive thought. So the real hardline answers sometimes don't fit really well. Like when somebody comes to me, and I was really stuck, you know, this, and I'm sure they use this out in New Mexico as well. It's found this way out here, but this idea, 90 meetings, 90 days, you know, 90 meetings, 90 days. Well, that's great. If somebody comes to me and they don't have a job and they're drawing unemployment, they're not even thinking about looking for a job, they just need to kind of get better, I'm going to tell them to go to an AA meeting every day until I tell you to stop. I just want you in meetings every day, all day long, if you can. You know, just kind of hang out. To go to lots and lots and lots of meetings. And that's the right answer for that guy. But if a woman comes to me, and she's a single woman, or a single guy, with one or two or three kids, do you see what I'm talking about? It's a cruel message. 90 meetings in 90 days. It's got to be, you know, we got to be intuitive. Like, and the big book tells us to find out all you can about the person, because you'll be better able to put yourself in their shoes to see how you would like to be treated if you were in that place. It takes the intuitive thought, the inspiration when you're working with these people. So, and I have had that circumstance, the single parent with kids. And what I tell them is well, you come to my house once a week and you bring your kids and we'll make them dinner. My wife and my daughter will watch your kids while you and I do the work, and I'll work it out with my wife. And I'll tell them, and then you come to the one meeting a week at my home group. And at my home group, we have daycare. So when you come to my home group, you bring your kids and we'll watch your kids for you. And we hire professional daycare people, people that know how to handle kids, and we know the kids are going to be safe. And so you come to the one meeting a week. You bring your kids. You bring your kids to my house once a week. And the rest of the week, if you can arrange a babysitter or something, get to a couple other meetings, that's great. But let's just do that for now. We'll talk on the phone a few times, and we'll get you started on some step work. That's exactly the opposite message I gave the other guy. But the circumstances were different. And it's the same thing with how many times will I let a guy miss an appointment before I cut him off? Well, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a set. You know, it's not like a three strikes you're out rule at my house. Joe came up with an excuse letter, so he's okay. Probably paid Brendan to write. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, we have to be intuitive on this stuff, and there isn't the right answer. And that goes even a little deeper in the spiritual life. There was a guy one time, that I was reading a lot of, and what he used to say is, he used to say in the spiritual life, the "I don't know" is a lot of times the right answer. He says, when you arrive at the "I don't know," a lot of times you're already home, he says. And there's so many things going on in the spiritual world that I don't have answers for. And he said, sometimes the "I don't know" is better than this extreme effort to find the answers, that when we do find them, they're only partially satisfying. And I think you all know what I'm talking about. We find these answers sometimes in the spiritual life for why does this happen, or why does that happen, or why is there, you know, why, if there's a God, does this stuff take place, and all of these kinds of things. Well, sometimes the "I don't know" is you're already home, because the answers to some of those kind of questions, in my experience, in the end, my own experiences, they've only been partially satisfying anyways. So I have a little dog at home. It's a half Chihuahua, half toy rat terrier, little fella. And you know, I look at that dog and I think, well, its capabilities are kind of limited in a lot of respects. That dog, and it's actually, it's my wife's dog. I got to correct that. But she spent so much time with that dog. That dog can do all kinds of tricks. I mean, it's really a tricky little dog. It can do, it does the, you know, it plays dead. It does the sit down. It fetches stuff. It does she's got it doing these agility training courses where it does the weaves and the jumps and goes through hoops and stuff, all kinds of things. And, you know, it's a great little dog, but I'm never going to teach that dog to fix my computer. You know, its capacity to do certain things are limited. And I've kind of got to a thought place where I think it'd be kind of rather arrogant of myself to think that maybe I'm not limited in some fashion myself. That if I could get my mind wrapped around God, I wouldn't really need God, would I? You know, I would kind of be this person that just has all the answers myself. So I just kind of put that out, because a lot of questions that people ask, you know, they're really, maybe there's not a really direct answer. You know, it's more about, well, what are you inspired to do? What's your intuition tell you? Those are the kind of directions that I think are more helpful in these situations. Or we can just share our experience that, hey, that heading down that road is a big waste of time. I've already done it. Don't worry about it. Let's worry about this other deal instead. So I had a couple of those thoughts on my mind. I just wanted to throw them out there. Steps 8 and 9. You know, the step 8 is to make the list of all of the people that we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I think probably a lot of people from this group, I'm guessing, have kind of learned how to put their, you know, make their list and then put the names on 3x5 cards. And I really like that method. I really have found that that's very helpful, because if I'm having trouble finding somebody, it gives me a place to like make all my notes and phone numbers, and it gives me a chance to kind of go have one name in front of me and make go over my card. I just write things out on a 3x5 card. It's very simple. And part of my 3x5 cards are pluses and minuses. And when I start, I've got some people that there's absolutely no way I'm willing to go to. And eventually I get to a place where I have pluses on all my cards. I'm willing to go to all of those. And a lot of those are kind of getting into the spirit of amends. I get to a place where I do a few amends and I see that there's really nothing to be afraid of here, that I'm actually in a position where I'm being spiritually enlightened through going in this process of making amends. And I'm willing to go. Then I start saying, yeah, I'm definitely willing to do that, that, that. And when my cards get to be all pluses, then I can really honestly say I'm in step 9. And the big book tells us that we commence this new way of life, talking about 10, 11, and 12, as we clean up the wreckage for the of the past. So once you're in amends and you really are in this place where you don't have any amends that you're not willing to do, it's the time to start 10, 11, and 12. And I'll share a few amends experiences, and I think it'd be nice that, I'm going to stick to just my own experience in amends. One of the greatest things for me about amends, and it was more powerful to me than anything the book had to say about amends, is that I heard these amends stories from people in our groups, and there was, these guys that were going up and knocking on the doors of houses they'd burglarized. I just couldn't believe that anybody would do that. And actually, when I was very first sober, and one of the things that really kind of woke me up to the fact that there was a different kind of AA program than the one that I was working was, I mean that with all sincerity. It is funny now, but I really believed that the AA program I was working was the AA program, which meant, go to lots and lots and lots of meetings and try not to drink no matter what, and kind of share about your day and the problems that you were having in your life, and that was kind of AA, and the work the steps off the wall thing. Well, yeah, I think I've done that, and no, I'll never do that one. And that was I thought that was kind of how AA worked, kind of a one step a year deal or something. Don't get too carried away here. I was in early sobriety. I was working down at that car lot. Al was giving me the $5 an hour down there. And of course, I didn't want to spend that $5 on myself or food and stuff because, I might need to show off to one of the girls at the club or something, buy them a latte. Oh, let me get that for you or something with my $15 that I had for the day. I was going to be buying other, try to play the big shot and buy somebody a coffee or something. So instead of buying my cigarettes, I would steal my cigarettes. I honestly really did. I looked at it back in those days as kind of a matter of intelligence. Like, why pay? These people are really stupid. Why would you pay for something that you can so easily boost at the store? And I thought that about everything. I thought, why would anybody buy a color television set at the store? I just couldn't figure that out because, you could go downtown and get them for like $15. You just tell them what you want, and you come back the next day, and they got your RCA, and $15, $20, and you got a new TV. That's the way I came into the program with that kind of a mindset, that I looked down on other people that were living a normal way of life. And so I was boosting cigarettes. And this guy named Jimmy Rector, who was part of that first workshop that I talked about, he was coming into the meetings, and he was sponsored by a guy in our area who was a priest that sponsored people, but he was a heavy-duty big book guy. And Jimmy was sponsored by this priest, and I knew that, he had some pretty heavy-duty sponsorship. But Jimmy was coming into the meetings and saying, and this was when you could smoke in AA, and I was smoking away these stolen cigarettes, and Jimmy was coming in and saying, I just made 6 more amends today to stores where I shoplifted from. God, it'd make me so dang nervous. I have to light one, stole a cigarette right off the other one. I'd just be like, holy cow, man. I mean, it really freaked me out because here I'm stealing, and this guy's talking about making amends to these stores that he used to shoplift it from. And it made me very uncomfortable. I wish he wouldn't. I just kind of was hoping. But it really woke me up, too. It really was part of that decision of, I am going to go down to that workshop these guys are talking about. I'm going to go down there because it woke me up to the fact that, man, this guy's AA program is way different than the kind of AA program I'm working. And I saw him, I could see the lights coming on, and he was one of those guys, and you hear the story around, he was one of those guys that he was one of those guys that had the experience of drinking at a young age and being just a downright dirty drunk right from the start. He was a young kid, got sober when he was young, and he's still sober today. But he was like, he took a drink, and at 15 he was living in the dumpsters. He was that kind of a guy. Just went quickly as a young person, got into AA, and he needed that full deal. The terms for that guy were the same as they are for me, and he made his amends and kind of got me going on that deal. Some of those amends stories that we share around the program are so important that we share this stuff with people. And it's one of those encouraging things that kind of took the fear out of the amends a little bit for me. And I have done all those things. I made that amends to my mom for all that crap that I did. And the thing that came to me, and I worked with a sponsor, and I would suggest that anybody that's making amends, work with a sponsor so that you don't go make amends to the ex-girlfriend with ulterior motives first, you know. That's not the one that, oh, yeah, I think I'll go to her first. But, you know, I got a chance to go to my mom and sit and talk with my mom. And, you know, I'd stolen, I'd done all kinds of things, took the money out of her purse, all these kind of things. And my sponsor said, you know, Kenny, you can bring that up, but that's not what she's concerned about. You know, you took this right for her to be a mother away. And you need to let her know that, you know, that you want her to be a mother. And you need to let her know. And I did too. And I saw, and we talked about this at lunch a little bit too. You know, my mother carried this huge amount of pain about the kind of mother she'd been. And I saw that get healed during that amends when I told her that, I remember when you used to play guitar to us every night. I told her about, remember the Christmas tree? I remember, and man, she just bawled, you know. She just said, I didn't think you remembered that stuff. I didn't think, you know, I just thought you hated me. I didn't think you remembered any of that stuff. And it was just, you know, one of those intuitive thoughts that my sponsor had. That, no, I don't think you want to talk too much about stealing all those tools out of her garage and all that. She knows that you did that. She knows that you took that money out of her purse. You know, she wants to hear that you remember all the good things. That's what's really going to make a difference for her. Tell her that you remember that she was a good mom. You know, that made a huge difference. I got a chance to make amends to my sister. My sister had not known how far downhill I had gone. And I hadn't really lived, you know, this sister was 8 years younger than I was. Is 8 years younger than I am, I should say. 8 years younger than I was. She's 8 years younger than I am. And so I never really lived with her. I mean, I was out of the house and she, you know, my mom got sober when I was like 13. She was five. And so she kind of had a much different upbringing. My stepfather was out of the house at this time and gone. So it was just her and my mom. And she had a little different upbringing. But she called me. My mom had moved to Vancouver, Washington. I was still in Seattle. She got accepted to Cornish, which is an art institute in Seattle. And she wanted to come up to go to school at Cornish. And she called me and her older brother that lived in Seattle. And she really didn't know fully what was going on. She knew I partied a lot, but she didn't fully know what was going on in my life. And she asked if she could come up and live with me and go to Cornish. She didn't have enough money to, like, rent an apartment. And I was on the spot a little bit. Well, yeah, I said, come on up. You know, I'll help you out. And she came up, and the scene was just this horrid scene in my house. And somehow, even sober all that time, I really believed that my sister didn't fully understand what was going on in the house, because I told all my friends, hey, let's kind of keep things on the down low here a little bit. You know, it's okay to drink or smoke a little pot or something, but, you know, hard drug, we'll take that to the back of the house. You know, so... And I thought that was working. Like, she doesn't know what's going on. She's just coming and going to school and stuff. And she doesn't really realize what's going on in the house. But the house completely fell apart. I had a couple of roommates. The house completely fell apart. My sister was forced to move in with this boyfriend that she barely knew. But she, you know, she had to pack her bags and go somewhere. And she was enrolled in school. And this guy was abusive. And it was just a bad situation. So I was making amends for that. And I was taught in amends that we always, you know, that we say our part, and then a big part of the amends is the listening. That I ask some questions and I do a lot of listening in amends. And I ask, did I leave anything out? I ask, what is it that I can do? I ask, did I leave anything out? I ask, how did this, do you need to tell me how this affected you? And I ask, what is it that I can do to make it right? And then I do those things. And those questions, you know, I ask these people, and I ask my sister, you know, did I leave anything out? And do you need to tell me how this affected you? And she said, well, yeah. She said, do you know during that time that I was so upset emotionally at what was happening to you that I couldn't eat? And she said, do you know that I was in the bathroom throwing up because my guts were just wrenched? And she said, I would go in at night, all night long, I would come into your bedroom and check to see if there was still a pulse, to see if you were still alive. She said, I thought I was going to have to call mom and tell her that I'd found my brother dead. And I had no idea. You know, I had no idea up to that point that had ever happened. You know, I kind of remembered that I had, you know, that the house thing hadn't worked out very well. I had a lot of amends that were like that. These things, I told you about the Friday night, I told you about falling asleep with cigarettes was kind of a problem that I had. And... I made amends to this girl, and I said, you know, is there anything, you know, am I leaving anything out? And she said, well, yeah, you fell asleep with a cigarette and burned my bed up, you know. You owe me a bed. And I still haven't had a chance to buy her a bed, but she knows that I will someday. She actually said, well, that bed didn't belong to me. It belonged to my sister. And I got a hold of her sister and offered to buy her a bed. And she said, well, someday maybe. And but you don't owe me anything for now. And so I stand ready if they ever need to a bed, either one of them, that I will be willing to buy a bed. But I made an amends. But that same girl that I made that amends to was one of them. And there's about five of them now that are in the program. Was one of the people that I made amends to, and when I got to the what is it that I can do to make it right, they said, well, you can tell me what in the hell are you doing that's changed you like this, because I was a, you know, a different person. They want to know, how did you stop drinking? How did you stop drinking? What are you doing? And there's like five of these people now that are a couple of them members of my home group, people that I went to amends. Do amends, people that were drinking and drugging, people that were kind of running partners and stuff. I had a guy that, you know, on my little resentment list, it was Yogi. He left me for dead. Remember I told that story about that guy that would come by? His job was to come by in the mornings to the hotel room and knock on the door and see if I was still alive. He would knock, and then I would come to the door, and he would say, hey, just checking, just, you know, I'm on my way to work. I just was worried about you. I'm just checking to see if you're doing all right. Oh, yeah, man, I'm cool. Thanks for coming by. But he and I, you know, I mean, you know, we do a lot of damage to people. And he was a good friend for many years. And I actually kind of found the hard drugs. And I kind of like told him, oh, this is, you know, you're not going to believe how cool this is. You know, come with me, man. I'm going places, you know, come hang out with me for a while. And he didn't. It destroyed his life. And we were doing some deals up in Seattle, and I got really, really, really sick in this hotel room. And he took the rest of the money that we had left, which wasn't much. You know, we were on our way downhill, and he had a huge habit at this time. And he took the rest of the money, and he split, and he went to California, and I didn't see him for several years. And, you know, I kind of told people, well, if I ever see that guy, or I'm going to, you know, we're going to, and I made a lot of threats. And this was like a guy who'd been a childhood friend. And you know, when I got sober, I realized, you know, the resentment was that I had, you know, that he'd left me for dead in this hotel room. And the truth was, is that I had placed him in this position. That was the truth of it. I remembered it clearly, talking him into this whole deal, telling him, come with me, or we're going to make lots of money. This is going to be really cool. And it was just a total disaster. And I put him in that position, and I called and made that amends to that guy. And a couple days later, he called me back and he said, I'm in real trouble down here. I'm in real trouble and I need some help. And I was able to get on a plane, take time from work, get on a plane, fly down to Los Angeles on my own. And you know, the great thing about that, and my sponsor helped me with that, he said, you go, you know, well, don't I need to take somebody with me? No, you're safe and protected here, dude. You're all right. You go. And I went, you know, it says that we can go to the most sordid places on earth if we're armed with this, you know, armed with the facts about ourselves, we're armed with this mess. We can go to the most sordid places on earth. And this was, you know, this was, I went down to Los Angeles. He was living in this crappy house. He had this girlfriend that was just a raging Al-Anon. And the whole time I'm trying to help this guy, she is literally, he's trying to kick on a couch and he's shaking and, you know, got the cold sweats and his nose is running and he's just in bad shape. And this girl is actually kicking him, like walking over and just wham, just saying, you know, I don't know why you're trying to help him. You know, this guy, he's not going to ever amount to anything, and he's just a lousy bum. I don't know why I'm letting him stay here. And it was just, it really was this most sordid place on earth. And I put him in touch. I got down there. We did a few things. I got him in touch. We had dinner with Kevin C, whom some of you might know, and Joe, and got him hooked up with some of the meetings down there. And you know, he still wasn't, you know, he was still kind of chipping away when I left. And the whole time I was a little, you know, I mean, I'd done some deeds with this guy, and I wasn't really comfortable like telling him, hey, by the way, I found God, you know, and now it's all, I kind of, you know, I just was telling him I found the solution. I wanted other people to kind of, but in the end, just before I flew out of Los Angeles, I told him, I said, here's the real deal, is that, you know, I'm living this spiritual way of life, and I'm praying, and and, you know, would you mind doing a prayer with me? And he was like, well, you know, I guess it couldn't hurt. And be all right with me. And I had a rental car. I was just dropping him off. And I sat and held his hand, and we did a prayer in the car. And I left. You know, that was my amends. And I left. And I got up to Seattle, and there was a message on my machine. And he said, man, I don't know what happened. But, you know, after that prayer, you know, I just was, you know, I really think I'm done. And I'm going to call those guys. I'm going to do what I can. You know, I was at the San Diego World Convention with that guy. He's sober about 11, 12 years now. You know, he's still sober today, all that stuff. And that was like out of that was born out of a resentment of a guy who left me for dead, you know, just one of those unforgivable things, you know, just terrible, unforgivable. Yeah.
What happened to
Al-Anon? They are still together, and she is still... I got to think about this. This is being burned onto a CD. So she's not currently attending Al-Anon, and I wish she would. Yeah, she could really benefit from that. And they are still together, and they have a child together. And so, yeah. So, you know, I mean, I can tell you story after story after story like this of things that had happened. I'll tell you a story about my grandfather, when I was a young teenager and I was really in trouble, my grandfather kind of picked me up and said, "Hey, listen, come on down here." He was working for a company that owned some ships. "Come on down, we'll put you to work." Well, you know, his kind of idea was, you know, we'll pull you up by your bootstraps, we'll stick you on a boat going up to Alaska, and it'll straighten your ass out. And he was right. It actually worked, actually. You know, I really did. I straightened it out. I kind of became a man a little bit. I learned how to work hard. And even though I was partying like crazy during those years, I actually kind of made something of myself. I actually got a house. That house that my sister came to stay at was a house that I'd gotten from this job. And I actually bought my first brand new car. But I lost all that stuff eventually. And this family was a family business that my grandfather worked for, and he got me that job. And I went to, you know, that family ended up putting me through treatment twice. I ended up stealing from that family. I ended up doing all of those kinds of things that we do. And I really, you know, destroyed this guy's confidence. And he actually told my family that, you know, after we had that Thanksgiving disaster, and he came to visit me. I was in a hospital, and I was trying to detox, and somehow he found out I was there. I called my mom or something, and then he came up to visit me, and he just came in and looked at me, and he just started crying. He said, "Oh my God, I didn't realize that you'd gone down this far," and he left, and he told my family, "We've just got to write him off. There's nothing more that we can do for this guy. We've done too much. You know, don't give him any money." And he just kind of wrote me off, and I'd really destroyed his confidence. And I was really trying my best to make the amends. And I made the amends to my grandmother. She accepted the approach. You know, I made the approach, and I got the appointment set, and I went and I did the amends with my grandmother. My grandfather wouldn't see me. He stayed. He was in the house, but he actually stayed in a little deal he called the den, you know, where he would go into his den and stay there. And so my sponsor just says, "No, you keep going. You start showing up there. You're..."